여기 야어 저.
아. 어. 세. 오. 다르죠.
Therefore, the idea of the good must be the cause of the ideas as well as of cognition. The idea of the good must be related to the ideas on the one hand and cognition on the other, as the sun is related to the visible things on the one hand and sight, seeing on the other.
This question surely is Adam writing here. The unity of the whole. The unity of the whole, and that is surely a mere sketch and not is only an indication of the way, of the direction in which Plato saw this unity and
should be at the mercy of man's judgment.
Of man's judgment, yeah? And read this, only the last sentence of this paragraph. Opinion is the grave of virtue among men, yeah? And her throne among women. I.e. a man who depends on what the others say about him, he can no longer be a virtuous man. He is completely other, how do they say? Other oriented?
Huh?
Other directed. And therefore he cannot be self-directed, he cannot be virtuous. But the woman must be other directed. And therefore her education must be radically conventional. Good. Now where did I put my notes? Yeah, we have to, this is clear. Now let us turn to page 330, paragraph 4.
I will not venture upon the reasons which induce women to encase themselves.
No, is this page 330, the fourth paragraph? Oh yes, I'm sorry.
Encase themselves in these coats of mail. A clumsy figure, a large waist, are no doubt very ugly at 20, but at 30 they cease to offend the eye. And as we are bound to be what nature has made us at any given age, and as there is no deceiving the eye of man, such defects are less offensive at any age than the foolish affectations of a young thing of 40.
Yeah, well, I think so, and I thought this would be of interest because of the changed figures, I mean numbers, yeah. I mean, perhaps one can say today an 80-year-old grandmother or grandmother looks in her dresses like a 10-year-old girl. Is this not, or am I totally mistaken? Now this is interesting for the understanding of democracy. Democracy means, of course, equality, naturally. But this equality does not go with its particular kind of inequality. There is a preferred state. Now, in the case of women's dresses, I believe that is particularly clearly recognizable. I mean, well, I will be corrected if anyone, especially the ladies, say I got my facts wrong. They are based on a very superficial study of these matters. But I have the feeling that there is a certain preferred age, let me say 22. And every, those women who are in the thrall of these fashions, all would like to look like a girl of 22. Whether they are 15 or 85 doesn't make any difference. In the case of men, it's more interesting. That's interesting because there are two preferred types. The junior executive, as one may say, and the senior executive. And it is very hard to say which is preferable. You know, the gray hair here, and so gives a man a kind of distinction which the junior executive would not have in Bajura. Now, so that is a way in which nature, as I said before, that the political virtue can be acquired by teaching. And now, read the beginning of the next sentence.
So, if you will think, Socrates, of what punishment can do for the evildoer,
You will see it once.
No, this will teach you. Yeah? He uses the word teaching here because he uses now, what he is preparing is the assertion that punishment is a major agency of teaching. Yes? And therefore the paradoxical use here. Yeah? If you only will consider punishment, it, the punishment, will teach you. Yes? Someone raised his finger.
In another translation, he said virtue is to be acquired by application and learning.
Yeah, that would
it's
be
not
better.
Education.
No, not alone. Surely not. Application. But still, a punishment would not ordinarily be. Inflicted punishment is not what we understand by application. Unless you spontaneously go to the flogger and say, I'm very eager to be flogged in order to become better. Yes?
The practice part dropped out this time. What it is that teaches. Before it was application, practice, and teaching. Here it's just application.
Yeah, but Melaya means really something more like care to be concerned with, would be more literal. Yes.
Surely that explanation he gives of why men are angry is an ironically high view of men?
What?
Well, he said that a man becomes angry clearly because he thinks that this could all have been prevented by study.
Yeah, but still, look at a simple case of anger, say, abroad in the street. What is it about? And disregarding the cases of simple drunkenness also, what is it about? Is it not in most cases because someone feels to be offended by something what the other said or did? I.e. by some injustice which the other committed? You mean the cases of wanton aggressiveness?
No, I was thinking of, big matter. We came on this in the Gorgias, that the child who kicks the table seems to be a show of anger in its natural origin.
Yes. But the question is, perhaps this will become clearer when we read the whole. I mean, in other words, it does not depend of whether that is a complete analysis here of anger and indignation, but what progress means in this context. So let us first read and return to the question if it is still necessary.
If you will think, Socrates, of what punishment can do for the evil doer, this will teach you that in the opinion of mankind, virtue may be acquired. No one punishes the evildoer under the notion or for the reason that he has done wrong. Only the unreasonable fury of a beast is so vindictive. But he who desires to inflict rational punishment does not punish for the sake of a past wrong which cannot be undone. He has regard to the future, and is desirous that the man who is punished, and he who sees him punished, may be deterred from doing wrong again. He punishes for the sake of prevention, thereby clearly implying that virtue is capable of being taught. This is the notion of all who punish others, either privately or publicly. And the Athenians especially, your fellow citizens, no less than other men, punish and correct all whom they regard as evildoers.
It is nicer in the origin, the other human being does that, and not the least the Athenians, your fellow citizens. They are particularly grand punishers. Yeah. Yeah. Yes?
And hence we may infer them to be of the number of those who think that virtue may be acquired and taught. Thus far, Socrates, I have shown you clearly enough, if I am not mistaken, that your countrymen are right in admitting the tinker and the cobbler to advise about politics, and also that they deem virtue to be capable of being taught and acquired.
Yes. Now, you see here very clearly the difference between the two propositions, that virtue, in the sense of moderation and justice, can be taught, does not prove that statesmanship can be taught. And especially if you add in each case every human being. Every human being can perhaps be made just and moderate, but no one would say that everyone can be made a statesman. And this behavior is to be conducted that. Justice and these other qualities here, piety and so on, are brought about not so much by teaching and application and training, but by punishment. In other words, the translation of the mythical expression gift of Zeus is punishment. And here you see the great difference between the arts and the political virtue. While, at least in former times, an apprentice with a shoemaker or someone else got a lot of spankings, but the true instruction in the art of shoemaking did not consist in the spanking. He had to show him. But here in this case, the spanking alone would be enough. You can also say, if the word punishment is too harsh, social pressure. But that's also kind of punishment, of course. The arts proper are not acquired by social pressure. The inclination to choose this or that profession may be due to social pressure, but not the learner of the art. Now, this doctrine of punishment, of which this is the earliest statement, is identical with the Platonic. There's no difference here. And no punishment merely for the sake of revenge, merely for a kind of equalization of pain and pleasure, as we have read in Grotius, you remember? I have had suffered pain because someone did me wrong, and the equalization demands that he also suffered pain. This is very far from Socrates and even from Protagoras. It must either improve the evildoer or deter other evildoers. Let me the latter, in case the evildoer is not improvable, then he must be executed. We are not squeamish about that. But then the execution, especially if it is public and speedy, not one appeal after another for years and years, and perhaps even somewhat spectacular, makes a deep impression on all who saw it. Yes. Machiavelli is a good man to read on this subject when he describes how Cesare Borgia used a kind of Himmler in order to get some order into the Romagna, the country around Rome, where there were so many robber barons and so. And then after he had used him, and he Cesare unpopular because of the toughness of this guy, he had him cut into four pieces, and one morning the people of this town found this Ramiro was his name, I call him Himmler, on the marketplace, cut into pieces, and then of course they still were more overawed by Cesare Borgia than even before, because he proved to be opposed to such cruel measures. At any rate, here this let me first say what I have to say about it. Again, we see here that political art, the political virtue, and virtue unqualified are used synonymously. But if this question arises, if the human agency for producing virtue is punishment, how can Protagoras claim to be a teacher of virtue? Will not all potential pupils run away from him because he inflicts much greater hardship on them than Hippias, no, who of whom he spoke, he inflicts mathematics on them. And that is already bad enough. But if he does it, yes. Good. Now, someone raised his hand or finger.
That was
I see. All right. Now then let us go on.
There yet remains one problem, which is...
aporia is a bit more, a bit different. Aporia means absence of a way out. Do you still, is not apori used also in present-day scholarly jargon? The absence of a way out. Now, what would be the best equivalent of that?
Dead end?
No, not dead end, but...
Does it mean there's one more embarrassment? Or?
Yeah, predicament. Predicament might do, yeah. Yes.
There yet remains one predicament, which has been raised by you about the sons of good men.
Yes, what? Men here, hombres. We have hombres. Now he comes closer to the real problem, because these hombres are, of course, the potential addressees of Protagoras' teaching. Yeah?
What is the reason why good men teach their sons the knowledge which is gained from teachers, wise, make them wise in that, but do nothing toward improving them in the virtues which distinguish themselves? And here, Socrates, I will leave the myth and resume the argument.
The Logos. Now that's terrific. Didn't he talk non-mythically already for two pages? But here we have it straight from his mouth that this was still myth hitherto, although not mythically expressed. Now let us see what this means. Hitherto Protagoras has only confirmed Socrates' or the Athenians' view that the political art or political virtue or virtue in general is not teachable, except if you identify teaching with punishment. Only on this one. Now he begins really to take issue with Socrates. Now the issue becomes serious. And an expression of that is that he says everything preceding was myth. The whole treatment of the difficulty caused by Athenian democracy. You remember that the Athenians permit everyone to speak on political matters, but not on expert specialist matters. The whole treatment of the predicament caused by the Athenian democracy is myth. The difficulty caused by the practice of the good men, the good hombres, cannot be treated mythically. And we know already the reason. Because these good hombres cannot be fooled. As Protagoras has said, the multitude you can fool, and you can tell them songs, but you cannot do this in the case of these clever men who run the cities. And the presupposition of all this is, of course, that the teaching of Protagoras, which Protagoras supplies, as distinguished what men in general supply, is addressed only to the potential hombres, and not to the shoemakers, and so on. Yes. Good. Let us see how he comes to this point.
Please consider.
As you see, this is a little example illustrating what I said before, that it is not so easy to say what is and what is not a Platonic myth. This part, obviously non-mythical speech, from 323 on to 324, see, belongs to the myth, although it is no longer mythical. Here is a transition. Yes?
Please consider. Is
that, that shows already the transition. We are not, yeah. Reflect in the following. Reflect, that is reasoning, no longer myth. Myth means you are told a story and you listen to it. Yes?
Is there, or is there not, some one quality of which all the citizens must be partakers if there is to be a city at all? In the answer to this question is contained the only solution of your difficulty. There is no other.
You see, also the way of speaking is now logical and in no way mythical. Reflect a question and then a reasoning. If this and this is so, and if this and this is so, that and that follows. Yes?
For if there be any such quality...
If there be such one thing, yeah.
If there be such one quality, and this one thing is not the art of the carpenter, or the smith, or the potter, but justice and self-control and piety, and, in a word, human virtue, if this is...
Again, the virtue of an hombre. Yes. And that is very paradoxical, as you will see.
If this is the quality of which all men must be partakers, and which is the very condition of their learning or doing anything else, and if he who is wanting in this, whether he be a child or an adult man or woman, must be taught and punished until by punishment he becomes better, and he who rebels against instruction and punishment is either exiled from the city or condemned to death under the idea that he is incurable.
And we must stop here in the sentence because otherwise it will be too much material. So that he speaks truly of the one thing needful, the unum necessarium, is very strange. The unum necessarium, the one thing needful in which all citizens must partake, is justice, moderation, and saintliness. I will translate it now differently because it's a different Greek word. That is to say, the virtue of an hombre. Now you see, he does no longer speak here of political virtue, as is shown very clearly by the reference to children and women in the immediate sequel. Now what this means, this change to, he had spoken of piety before, but not of saintliness. We have seen before Protagoras had replaced justice and moderation by justice and piety. And this would in itself permit the conclusion that he identifies moderation and piety. And this is not absurd. You see from what I told before that moderation can be used as the opposite to hubris, to insolent pride, and then it becomes immediately clear. Now, but this word, sophrosyne, had also been identified with caution. You know, when he spoke, one should not, a man who would not reveal, he would reveal his injustice and not pretend to be just, although he's unjust, is lax this sophrosyne. So sophrosyne is a caution which commands to lie. And which conclusions to be drawn from that, I leave to you. Now, however, Protagoras adds saintliness to justice and moderation. The meaning is partly clear from the context. He drops political virtue in any emphatic sense and includes the virtue of women and children, of whom no one would expect the political art, the art of the states. Perhaps this saintliness comes in with a view to women and children. Protagoras surely is here completely silent of that, about that virtue which he teaches. Now a word about this saintliness. The Greek word is hosiotes. Now this word is used in two different connections. The saintly is used in contradistinction to the just. And then it means the just things are things of divine order, of human ordinance. And the saintly are things of divine ordinance. But the distinction means also this, that the just consists of the duties toward men, there is a saintly of the duties toward the gods. But there is another opposition. This saintly Hosion is also used in contradistinction to Hieron, to the holy. And then in this connection, the Hosion, the saintly, means the profane in the literal sense. What is in front of the temple, profano. And what is in the temple is a saintly. And what is outside of the temple but still demanded by the gods, yeah, but regarding our profane action. For example, Aristotle uses in the Politics, I believe, the term Hosion only once, and when he speaks of abortion, up to which point abortion is permitted, beyond which it is no longer saintly, and it has always this implication of a divine law. Now, at any rate, this much is clear. The virtue of which Protagoras speaks here consists of three virtues. We never had so many before. Justice, moderation, and saintliness. And it so happens that he enlarges here also the addressees of these things into three groups: children, men, and women. And I have indicated that there could be a connection between these two things. However, let us go on here to achieve as much as we can without rushing. We are still in the midst of that long conditioned sentence.
Well, how can, after listing justice, moderation, and saintliness, how can he then call that the virtue of the hombre, the andros, I think, especially if later on he applies that to women and children as well?
Yeah, that is a great problem, that's a week which we cannot clear up now. Well, I can only give a general answer. Protagoras confuses the issue. Whereas originally it was clear what he was teaching was something addressed to the cream of Athens, the male cream of Athens. And now he drowns that, as it were, into something which every child, every woman, and perhaps even every slave is supposed to be. And why he does it, and so we must see, but we must first have the facts together.
Is it?
Well, but in order to satisfy Mr. Schalsky and not keep him in an unnecessary suspense, because I cannot be as cruel, the point is this. Well, the simplest thing is I read to you my statement at the end of this passage, and then we go on. Protagoras claims to teach human beings, yeah, anthropo, because, and not hombres, because hombres in the strict sense are only men like him, of course, wise men. To educate human beings in well-advisedness, which includes the art of speaking. And Socrates calls this the political art. Protagoras, in contradistinction to Gorgias, does not limit his claim to being a teacher of rhetoric. What he claims is much more. Well, advisedness concerns as much the thoughts as what you say. And Gorgias also made this mistake that he said he does not ordinarily teach justice. And then this was brought him into great troubles, you know, because then he would be responsible for the misuse of rhetoric by some unjust students. Now, Protagoras also Gorgias' claim is much more modest than that of Protagoras, but also much less cautious than the claim of Protagoras. Now, Protagoras puts a much stronger emphasis on the danger which he incurs than Gorgias, and on his precautionary measures. Do you remember that long speech? Is his great claim,
so to speak, that he teaches the political art in all sorts of, in all its aspects, not one part of his precautionary measures. In other words, that he guarantees the parents, your son, when he comes to me, will become juster, more moderate, more pious every day, which Gorgias never claimed. That may very well be, but there is a great difference of the danger of which he thinks. That means that the parents, the fathers, might be envious of this man who takes their sons away from him and whom they will more admire than their own fathers, an unbearable insult. But there is also another danger of which he did not think and of which Socrates reminds him, namely that which can be stated very simply as follows. You make a great mistake, Protagoras. You think that many can be trifled with very easily. You remember he said the many don't notice anything, so to speak. Here you are mistaken. The Athenian demos is very clever. And therefore, be warned by Socrates of the danger which he is running in Athens, he, in his long speech, drowns the distinction between the virtue of the top men, which he teaches, into the virtue which is expected of everyone, including women and children. So he, in contradistinction to Gorgias, brings into oblivion the fact that the art which he teaches can be misused. Gorgias had granted that his art can be misused, and that's not my fault. Gorgias is so cautious that no one who has heard this speech can any way think of the fact that his art can be misused, because virtue in the sense of, especially of justice and moderation, all the time. The whole world teaches moderation and justice, and I do. So that's good. But he doesn't leave it at that. He doesn't speak at all in this long speech of his own teaching. He speaks only of what other people see. The fathers, the vet nurses, and the nurses, and the pedagogues, the school teachers, and the city. And this is an amazing thing. After all, the whole speech had still meant to serve the purpose to make clear this ambitious but not very bright young man, Hippocrates, what will he learn from Protagoras? And then Protagoras makes this very long speech, surpassing in length all comparable speeches ever occurring in Plato. He makes this long speech, and the boy doesn't know a tiny little wee bit more of what Protagoras teaches. It's not amazing? And he makes his art, in other words, utterly unattractive to Hippocrates, because he brings it together with all these kinds of teachings through which he has gone through and which he loathes, grammar school, etc. And that's still more. No. In other words, Protagoras plays into Socrates' hands. Socrates doesn't have to say anything. He does exactly what Socrates wanted him to do. And the funny thing is that this is done by Protagoras, who boasts of his candor. He doesn't conceal the fact that he's a sophist. He is outspoken, because lack of outspokenness merely increases suspicion, makes life worse for you. He boasts of his candor, but he, owing to Socrates' warning, he is super cautious. So much so that he doesn't bring out at all what he is teaching. So much that he endangers his whole enterprise. In other words, and more simply stated, this teacher of well-advisedness is very poor at advising himself. Now, to what extent poor Hippocrates became aware of this marvelous game which Socrates is playing with Protagoras, it is impossible to say. But one thing he must have seen clearly, what is interesting about this kind of thing, he doesn't say a word in this long speech about his own contribution. Socrates had told him, what you are, in spite of your marvelous your marvelous candor and at the same time caution, he spoke of it at the same time, you don't see what you are up against here in Athens. This is a very clever demon. They cannot be so easily trifled with than the demons say in a Boeotian village. And there, you have to be very careful here. Now, Protagoras, without can't like two augurs laughing at each other, Socrates and Protagoras. Protagoras understands the hint, and he's very cautious, but he's too cautious. And this must have its effect on that poor boy. Good. Now, and this is my explanation of the fact that why there is this back and forth between the virtue of man, of hombres, and then that virtue which is expected of everyone, however low. Yes.
I shudder to do so, but may I give a lower explanation, more
please,
favorable to Protagoras?
Please. Maybe
perhaps not. When Mr. Schulze raised the question before Socrates was expounded, it struck me that this is consistent with the hypocrisy he urged before, and this happy hypocrisy is part of the political necessity, as the sophists see it, getting those who do not by nature have a certain virtue to partake in it, to get anthropoi to behave according to virtue, which by its nature belongs only to a few. But it happens to be necessary for more.
And but still,
to assume virtue,
but you must not forget that is very all right as far as it goes. But you must consider the context. Socrates came there with Hippocrates. You remember, he warned him that the dangerous thing, soul food, you cannot carry away in a basket. You have to carry it in your soul, and therefore if it corrupts, has a corrupting effect, it will have it right away. Do you see? Whereas if it is body food, you can still show it to an experienced man or woman at home and test it. And it's a very great risk you take. And how can Socrates be so unscrupulous to expose poor Hippocrates, the son of a fine family, to such nefast influences? Here we see. Socrates is such a marvelous manipulator. I mean, the word has now a very low meaning, but he's such a marvelous leader of souls that he makes Protagoras, this great Protagoras, dance to his tune.
I'm not denying. I was just saying that there was a certain truth in what Protagoras said, even if he was being led by the nose around it.
Yeah, sure. No, that is. I mean, otherwise, how could he have the reputation of parents? But still, think of that poor boy who came here to hear magnificent fireworks, as you would expect them from such people. And who was especially wishing to hear of a kind of teaching which was not as dull and as much interspersed with spankings as the teachings he has had hitherto. I mean, the fact that Protagoras had told him that he won't learn mathematics doubtless was a good bait. But this was a long time ago, and in addition, to say what you do not teach is not enough. You have also to say what you teach. This is, in my opinion, the reason why the bait, the virtue of the hombre, never completely disappears, but then it is also obscured by this ordinary virtue which even women are supposed to have, and which of course is in no way attractive to our slave hunting fellow Hippocrates. We are now in the middle of a very interesting story, but for sheer reasons of vulgar prudence, lest I create another scandal, I will stop here. I'm mighty glad that I could make it.
Effect which it would not have without this. That is, if one would use harsh and offensive terms, recommendation of hypocrisy. Because by denying the existence of desires, you do contribute to your control of desires in yourself and others. But theoretically it is wrong to say that the woman doesn't have the desire. Theoretically it's wrong, because she has these desires. But by denying it, she acts more decently than by admitting them. Well, look at it in practical terms. If a woman were compelled to be absolutely honest in this sense, and if someone makes her an improper proposal, she would say, I must say, I have a certain desire to accept your offer, but I control it. It is, of course, much simpler and better for both cases that if she is compelled to make any pronouncement on the subject, say, I have no desire for that. It's not clear. And nevertheless, it is not. This is, as I shall say, an almost fantastic case. But what Rousseau claims that this fantastic case is somehow involved in female conduct in general. That a woman must not in any circumstances. And this brings about, the identity of is and ought is brought about by a fictitious identification of that the non-avowed does not exist. Here, I think everyone sees that the non-avowed, it does not as such not exist. Yeah. Now, let us see. On page 349 in the last paragraph, which is very long, we cannot read that, it's too long. But the main point which Rousseau makes can be stated as follows. See truth will not become known without the contribution of by women. Women see certain very important things which men do not see. And this is of course also, this is also non-traditional, and is part of the boosting, if I may use this vulgar term, of the female sex, which Rousseau achieves corresponding to his boosting of children. Same principle. Yeah. There is no end, no rational end. I say no human type, which is the perfect type. Following from that is the equality of the ages and also the equality of the sexes. And the connection with the generally democratic doctrine is clear to the meanest capacities, as John Locke would say, express that. Yes. Yeah.
This is the paragraph beginning, the study, the research of abstract and speculative truths.
Yes, yes. This is not the he agrees with the tradition.
Yeah.
A woman cannot be a philosopher, strictly speaking. This is a paragraph to which I refer.
Well, that's a paragraph. I must say, beyond their inspiring men to something or other, to actions.
Oh no,
he says because they observe better than this is a consequence of their.
Let me see. You think I exaggerate? Mm-hmm. Now let me see. Is true. He says men will philosophize better than women on the human heart, but women will read better than they in the hearts of men.
Yeah.
I do not believe that, that men like Aristotle would accept that. Would not accept that.
From this better reading, they will inspire men to action. They are partly able to read better because they have this acuity of observation.
Yeah, but
very docile.
Yes, but I'm only concerned with the main point now. And please read on page 353 in the second paragraph.
These external signs are not devoid of meaning. They do not rest entirely upon the charms of sense. They arise from that conviction that we all feel that women are the natural judges of a man's work.
Yeah, please. Would Plutarch have said that? I mean, there are certain complications caused by the gossip of Athens about the contribution of Aspasia to Pericles' speeches, but this, that I know. But this was still, that has to do with a woman ruler and woman business woman, of which I spoke before. That's not a very good one. No, but this passage, I would say, shows clearly that woman comes off much better in Rousseau than she does in Aristotle's tradition.
Now, what about the fact that the little girl begins to babble more charmingly
than
the little boy. The little boy is dull and she's already clever.
Oh, that is
undeniable.
They are more precocious without any.
Especially appropriate to her, which is rather odd thing because no Roman considers ordinarily.
What?
The talent of speaking is especially appropriate to
women. Yeah, well, a certain insinuating way of speaking not only the literature, has frequently been said to be characteristic of the female sex. They are, always often been said that they can be more persuasive than men, frequently. But I think the problem is solved very simply, namely on a little bit later on the paragraph after the one to which we looked, near the beginning, when he speaks of the Spartan and German and Roman women, yeah? He says, all the peoples who have had manners have respected the women. That's all we need. In other words, the context of this has to do with the political or social as distinguished from the theoretical context. And that is, of course, from that point of view, it is perfectly natural. May I restate my argument again? I mean, on the basis of the way in which I understand Plato and Aristotle, which everyone is
entitled. Yes. Now, we have here theoretical and practical or political. Now, if this is the highest, it follows the single superiority of the male sex. Not of every man to every woman, that goes wrong, but of the peaks. But if this is denied, if the highest life is a practical political life, there is no longer the same compelling reason to assert the supremacy of the male sex. Rousseau, in his political context, avails himself of this possibility. Is this clear? I mean, take the simple scheme. There cannot be a female Aristotle. But there can be a female Alexander the Great. And therefore, if we speak only within political terms, the position of the woman is boosted beyond what it was as long as the belief in the supremacy of the males as well. Needless to say, there are many other considerations because even politically, there are very great objections made to the equality of the two sexes. I remind you, example of Spinoza's argument against the participation of women in government, which simply stated there is an element of, in our lingo,
of quote subjectivity unquote, which comes in whenever a council would also have a woman amongst them. You know, it's a very common male prejudice which you must have heard from older people. You know, the men do not argue as longer as objectively. And when the woman is present, then when no woman is present. That was, and this kind of thing. In other words, it has all to do with the same thing, less the passion. The woman is a more passionate being than the man. Yes?
Doesn't the Rousseauian go beyond the point that you put your schema on the board in this paragraph, the long paragraph that you didn't read, where he says that insofar as man is theoretical, that he's perfect, he owes his perfection to women?
You know, this is, I think, a reflection of that. I mean,
he simply can't go beyond simply casting out the theoretical, so that even, you know, in part because of the practical aspect, you have this equality between women. But then when you bring back the theoretical aspect, the woman adds this extra force to man's.
Yeah, but this is a minor footnote, which is necessary, but it doesn't affect the main point. Now, we have to consider page 345, paragraph 2. Let us read first the beginning.
354,
I'm very sorry. Then he has spoken of the famous Roman women. Yeah?
I will go further and maintain that virtue is no less favorable to love than to other rights of nature.
Is it not interesting that love is here called a right of nature? Well, this has resounded throughout the generations. Yeah? The right of love against parents who prevented their children from marrying one another, you know, all these other things up to the present day. Yes? Go on.
And that it adds as much to the power of the beloved as to that of the wife or mother. There is no real love without enthusiasm, and no enthusiasm without an object of perfection, real or supposed, but always present in the imagination. What is there to kindle the hearts of lovers for whom this perfection is nothing, for whom the loved one is merely the means to sensual pleasure? Nay, not thus is the heart kindled, not thus does it abandon itself to those sublime transports which form the rapture of lovers and the charm of love. Love is an illusion, I grant you, but its reality consists in the feelings it awakes, in the love of true beauty which it inspires. That beauty is not to be found in the object of our affections, it is the creation of our illusions.
Of our eros, yeah.
What matter? Do we not still sacrifice all those baser feelings to the imaginary model? And we still feed our hearts and the virtues we attribute to the beloved, we still withdraw ourselves from the baseness of human nature. What lover is there who would not give his life for his mistress? What gross and sensual passion is there in a man who is willing to die? We scoff at the knights of old. They knew the meaning of love. We know nothing but debauchery. When the teachings of romance begin to seem ridiculous, not so much the work of reason as of immorality.
Yes. Now, this ennobling character of delusions, yeah? And these delusions arise from the imagination. They are therefore not natural sentiments, according to the distinction made at the beginning of the work. Yeah? And this must ultimately be understood in the light of the fact that civil society is not natural. But how are they precisely linked, the natural sentiments proper and the one to which he refers? That is indicated in the following paragraph.
Natural relations remain the same throughout the centuries. Their good or evil effects are unchanged. Prejudices masquerading as reason can but change their outward meaning. Self-mastery, even at the behest of fantastic opinions, will not cease to be great and good.
Great and beautiful.
Beautiful.
Yeah.
and the true motives of honor will not fail to appeal to the heart of every woman who is able to seek happiness in life in her woman's duties. To a high-souled woman, chastity above all must be a delightful virtue. She sees
for a beautiful woman, he said. Who is very fun. Yeah. Who has some elevation in herself.
She sees all the kingdoms of the world before her, and she triumphs over herself and them. She sits enthroned in her own soul, and all men do her homage. A few passing struggles are crowned with perpetual glory. She secures the affection, or it may be the envy. She secures, in any case, the esteem of both sexes and the universal respect of her own. The loss is fleeting, the gain is permanent. What a joy for a noble heart, the pride of virtue combined with beauty. Let her be a heroine of romance. She will taste delights more exquisite than those of Lais and Cleopatra. And when her beauty is fled, her glory and her joys remain. She alone can enjoy the past.
Yeah. Now, what is there the link between the natural sacraments, the merely sensual things, and virtue? I think he makes it very clear. Glory, pride or glory. Yeah? In other words, this is the feeling of superiority over others, founded on her feeling of superiority over her desires. Amour propre. So as we see now how important it is, what Rousseau said in the second discourse, amour propre is the root of all our vices and all our virtues, necessarily. So in other words, the natural basis of these ennobling delusions, this which is what is natural in them, is a feeling of pride, superiority. This we must not forget. The point which Mr. De Selter made earlier, I prevented him from speaking, is, I think, that comes out most clearly on page 353 in the first paragraph.
Sorry.
No, this must be, let me see, in the first paragraph. Yeah. When in spite, that's a very long. We cannot possibly read. I mean, this is a question of a moral education, how to teach morality, and not always say duty, 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 but you must make duty is the source. How does he put it? Duty is the source
of their pleasures and the basis of their rights.
The foundation of rights. Yeah, in other words, which could be said also from another point of view, but as Rousseau means it, I believe it means duty for the sake of pleasure and for the sake of rights. And then duty becomes immediately attractive. Whereas if it is pitched as duty is not attractive. I believe that is what something of this kind is what Mr. Selzer had in mind, right? Yeah, sure. So, in other words, in spite of this seeming, the seeming restoration of older morality, reminding of the Stoa and other things, it is an entirely different spirit. I mean, one cannot see Seneca writing such a treatise on women. Now it is very late, but I can tell you. Now next Tuesday we will meet again, and then the Tuesday of the week following, because there will be Thanksgiving a week from today, and then we will be serving something.